Welcome to the Total Soccer Show and our latest round of listener questions. On today's episode, we're considering the Ballon d'Or frontrunners. We're recruiting for the TSS MLS expansion team. Oh boy. And we're asking if GM is the best job in soccer. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, one corner of a power trio today, Taylor Rockwell. Hello, Taylor.
Hello. Happy to be one of the corners.
Indeed, as am I, as is Mr. Joe Lowry. Hi, Joe!
Yes, I get to be one of the corners. I didn't know if Graham was going to pop out from his vacation and, like, you know, claim that third spot, but he didn't. Suck it, Graham. I'm a corner. You're not.
That's right. Graham Ruthven not with us today. En route to his spiritual home, Orlando, Florida. Taylor, if I was going to rank TSS hosts and their appreciation of Orlando, Florida, I might put you fourth.
Correct. That is the correct place to
put I would
put me.
Love that fourth spot, but Taylor's more vocal about his disdain for Florida. This is how I envision it, because I do think Taylor ultimately is right to be in that four spot. Ryan and Graham, Ryan, are you top? Is Graham top? I feel like Graham's top.
Graham's gone there more times than he was alive.
So Graham is top. Ryan is fairly close second. And then there is a massive Grand Canyon sized gap between two and three. And I'd like to think that Taylor, you and I are pretty close between three and four.
So why does it appeal to you, Joe? I know why it doesn't appeal to me. I misspoke there. Graham has been there more times than years he's been alive. There we go. Now it makes somewhat more sense. Ryan, I'm also going to guess, is not a huge fan, but like maybe just below Graham.
I love Orlando, Florida.
Really?
Yeah. It's my formative experience of American life was in Orlando, Florida. I love it.
Yeah, and that, I guess, is a totally fair reason. I'm not a fan of the climate. I don't have any real love. There's no drive, because I don't mind going to Disney. I enjoy going to Disney. I'm just going to go to Disneyland, which is like 5 hours away from me, rather than the country to go to Disney World. So there's just no real appeal to go to the Southeast rather than like hop over to California. It just doesn't appeal.
I mean, it's okay to be wrong about some things, Joe, as well.
We can, as you are in this case, obviously.
Yeah, you're outvoted here, my friend. You don't have Graham to support
Get
you.
It's 2-1.
Well, we appreciate all our Total Soccer Show listeners in Florida and the Orlando area as well. We love you, and we love your city. At least 50% of us do anyway. Patreon.com/Total Soccer Show for our bonus content. We've got plenty going on there. Bonus podcast episodes, bonus videos, and access to our Discord where all the cool kids are hanging out. If you'd like to support us in any way, patreon.com/Total Soccer Show is the way to do so. We've also got a bonus listener question, Taylor, coming up on the feed today. We're going to be talking about Weston McKennie. We're going to switch him up a little bit, aren't we?
Indeed.
We're going to transform him. Goalkeeper, right?
Take away the ranch, add goalkeeper gloves. It's going to be risky.
What we're really doing is Schalke-ifying him, and we'll get onto that more later.
Pretty much.
Taylor, you could pry the ranch dressing from his cold, dead hands, frankly. He shall not be parted.
Antonio Conte tried. It didn't work.
All right, let's get to today's listener questions. Another email address for you, totalsoccershow.com/questions, if you would like to submit, or, join the Discord. All the cool kids, as I say. Glorious Porpoise has been in touch. Brian McBride made his Premier League debut for Everton at age 30 and went on to score 45 goals in all competitions, mostly for Fulham, of course. Which current US player approaching 30 years old who's never played in a top four European league could most likely see a similar late career surge in a top four European league? Not five, Joe. Top four European league, specifically from Glorious Porpoise here. My one stab at this, and I'm not sure if there is a super accurate answer to this one, Walker Zimmerman, maybe? No?
Maybe. I have a really hard time seeing Walker Zimmerman. To back up from this, and I don't think it's a terrible shot, Ryan, because both of my potential answers are center backs. So we're sort of along the same line of thinking here. But I do love the big four shout from Glorious Purpose. Liga, are you really? Look at yourself. Are you? No. Okay, great. Well, let's move on. I have Miles Robinson at the top of my list, and I have Cameron Carter-Vickers on my list as well. One quick beat on Walker Zimmerman before I go deeper on Robinson and CCV. If he had not recently, this is probably a couple of years now, signed that DP deal in Nashville that's paying him very, very well, likely better than he would be able to fetch from any European Big Four team that he would be able to play for. It would be a lower table team. There are just lots of personal reasons, I think, in addition to the soccer reasons. But we were kind of on the same wavelength, Ryan, in terms of the center back idea here. These players are a little bit older, and it feels like they have maybe a tiny bit of upward mobility left in them. Robinson's 27, PSV, not a top four league team, but PSV have been interested. So there is some good progress there. If he performs well at PSV and maybe moves there after this year with Cincy, then he could go and maybe parlay that into a bigger league somewhere else in Europe. It's possible. And Miles Robinson was the oldest outfield player outside of Tim Ream back in the March roster. There just is a giant hole in terms of players that are approaching age 30 with the U.S. right now, which Trinidad and Tobago, Lost Generation, et cetera, et cetera. The other player I had on my list, CCV, he's been with Tottenham before, but he hasn't played a minute in the Premier League.
I was going to say, that feels like a technicality.
No, it is a technicality, I suppose. He's highly rated in Scotland right now with Celtic. I still don't really envision this happening. Graham, I think, is a bit higher on CCV than I am. So maybe there is still some opportunity for Cameron Carter-Vickers to go and move up one rung or a couple of rungs in Europe. But my actual answer to this question is, right now, there are very few players approaching 30, and I don't think any of the ones that are have a huge chance to go and play a role in a top four league.
Yep. Very similar answer, including Zimmerman and Robinson as my two potential candidates. I did rule out CCV for the Tottenham connection, though Joe is correct. He never played for them. So
thank you, says David Beckham from a doorway.
Ryan and I are now on one side. Sorry, Joe.
Nah, that's fine. Just because I read the question and it said played in a top four league, and you guys didn't read the question. It's fine.
But it is interesting, and I think Joe hit the nail on the head, which is that it's really interesting as a sign of how the pool has shifted, that we don't have nearly as many players approaching that age who haven't already sort of played in those leagues or haven't already gotten that one move. And so it does feel like it probably ends up, if it were going to be anybody, it ends up being a defender or a goalkeeper who maybe could play on later into their mid or late 30s. But I don't know if that's Zimmerman or Robertson, given the deals they have. I would have said goalkeeper, but again, we have goalkeepers who are kind of already playing in those leagues, or we have goalkeepers who are much, much younger. The only other one there would be like Sean Johnson, and he's moved to Toronto, last season? Maybe he ends up making a move, but it doesn't feel like one where he's setting the world alight in Major League Soccer, so he makes a move and plays 3 or 4 years. So I think it's probably Miles Robinson is the most likely answer, if there is an answer, but I think that shows just how much things have changed.
Yeah, I completely agree with the overarching take. That is where my line of thinking ended up going on this question, where you just think back to the failure to qualify for the 2018 World Cup. At that time, Christian Pulisic, Weston McKennie, Tyler Adams just starting to break through. Pulisic a little further along than those other two. And you're sort of waiting for who the next generation is going to be. You know, was the DeAndre Yedlin, Kellen Acosta is a bit younger, but that generation of players going to be enough to carry the U.S. to 2018? Clearly not, right? There is that gap in the player pool between the Landon Donovans and Clint Dempseys to really the Pulisic, McKennie, Adams era that we're seeing take charge of the U.S. right now. And that gap is manifested in there being no Brian McBride equivalent or, inferior, even slightly inferior option to Brian McBride. Those players just don't really exist in the U.S. pool. And again, a reason why I think we all ended up looking further back on this list, even outside of the U.S. angle and thinking about how players develop generally, I think you can survive longer as a goalkeeper. Taylor, you kind of got to this. You can survive a bit longer as a center back. And oftentimes those are the players that find sort of a late career push as well, where if you're an attacker and you're 28 years old, you're exiting your prime essentially. And you've already reached your athletic peak in terms of speed and in terms of acceleration, all that stuff. You can get away with stuff for longer as a player further back on the field. One more note on Miles Robinson, because you mentioned the contract that he's on, Taylor. He's actually on a very favorable contract in terms of getting to Europe. I'd imagine that was a very big part of him going to Cincinnati in the first place. His contract only goes through this year, and since he do have a club option for 2025, but you'd have to imagine there are some pretty close discussions about if Robinson wants to go, they're going to let him go. I don't know anything firsthand, but you'd sort of think that maybe that was part of the conversation. So I do think he is the best option for this, but I just still don't know how likely it is.
I just think, Joe, it's not likely for any player 30 and over to come to a top four European league and do what Brian McBride did in this day and age, surely, right? It's
not likely.
Sorry, I know you asked Joe, but I think That is correct, Ryan. I think it requires a connection to the club. It requires an existing connection at this point to be able to play in those years, like Tim Ream now with Fulham. I think if you don't have that, it's hard to come in, impress, get that spot in the starting 11, and then cement that spot in the starting 11 into your 30s.
Well, and it's especially difficult because we just really don't see that outside of Europe, right? I think about, it wouldn't be a huge shock if a 29-year-old who had a great season in Turkey maybe found his way to the Bundesliga or something along those lines, right? There are connections in Europe that feel stronger to me, where you go and maybe you were excellent in the championship at age 29 and you go up and get promoted or, you know, whatever it is in your league. Those connections are much stronger in country and in continent, I think, than they are across the Atlantic Ocean for the United States. Like, we just really don't see that happening. And that Brian McBride example is a really, really good one in all of this. That is another angle here. The other reason why, Ryan, to your original point, though, or question, like, we don't see this happen a lot regardless of where you live. The soccer transfer market has a lot of flaws, but one thing it is very good at is generally assigning talent to the appropriate level. Like, generally, the best players in the world at this point end up in specifically the Premier League, but in the top four leagues in the world. Then you go and you're looking at the next tier, maybe in Belgium and the Netherlands and Portugal and the bottom of Ligue 1. And, like, those are sort of the next best players. And then you find your way over to Brazil and Argentina and South America and Mexico and eventually Major League Soccer. Like, that's something the transfer market is good at. And so it's rare that the transfer market as this entity, this all-seeing, all-knowing entity, messes up so badly that someone who's good enough to play in the Premier League or in another major European league isn't there by the time they're 30 years old.
Yeah, that's right. That's why Timo Werner's at Spurs. He's earned his spot, as we all know. Thank you, Glorious Porpoise, for your question. Gritty for the Union up next. I'm having trouble telling who are the front runners for the Ballon d'Or.
All right.
In past seasons, it was easy to see Benzema or Messi taking the honour, but this year, there's not been as much noise around Mbappe or Haaland as we might expect, okay? And now that I'm looking at the goal-scoring tables in the Big Five leagues and the Champions League, if England goes deep in the Euros, is this award Harry Kane's to lose? Okay, Taylor, the last ceremony. Let me preface this by saying we all love the Ballon d'Or ceremony, right? We all think it's super.
We love it. Yeah, we all love it, great, universally.
And so we're all, our eyes were glued to the ceremony back in October, which is now based on the European season. I think it used to be a calendar season. They used to do it in like sort of January time, didn't they? Messi and Aitana Bonmati won the main player prizes at the most recent one. Haaland was second last time. Benzema was 16th. In the Ballon d'Or, men's Ballon d'Or last time, and Harry Kane was 19th. Taylor, do you know who the favourite is currently, according to the oddmakers at Bet365?
Is it someone English?
Yes.
Is it Jude Bellingham?
Yes.
That was going to be my nominee. There we go. All right. No, I did not know that, but I was thinking about this, and I think to the
listener
question,
should see the smile on Ryan's face right now. He is absolutely beaming.
I was wondering how Ryan would feel if he would be sad that it wasn't going to be Harry Kane, or likely wasn't going to be Harry Kane. I'm glad that Ryan is instead happy it's likely to be Jude Bellingham. I think that's the argument, is that if England make a deep run, especially given the season Real Madrid are having, especially if they continue to go on to the Champions League, and then if England made a run with Bellingham doing Bellingham things, he is definitely on the short list for me. I think if Brazil do well or win the Copa America with Vinicius playing well, he could get a shout. I think if France do well at the Euros, then it might end up being Mbappe. But it does feel more open to the point of the question, and I like that. It feels like the year that Luka Modric ends up winning it, when we get a sort of more open field where it can be based on actual performance, actual results, and actual competitions, as opposed to, it's Messi or Ronaldo. It's one or the other. Whoever had the better season between those two, I like it being a bit more open. I think it'd be fascinating if it were Jude Bellingham. I don't know if Ryan Bailey would ever stop talking at that point.
I would certainly appreciate the decision of the panel and the panelists on that one, Taylor. Joe, I suppose Erling Haaland's an interesting part of this question because, you know, there's this talk lately about him being too much of a luxury player if you're
a League Two player, Ryan.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. Where do you stand, Joe, on the front runners? And is it an Mbappe Haaland race? Is Jude in there? What do you think?
I think Jude is probably in there. To preface all this, I really struggle to care about the Ballon d'Or. It is a narrative award first and foremost, and it is very difficult in soccer, first of all, to go out there and pick who the best and most influential individual is. And it's also really, really hard to see that trend followed in the Ballon d'Or winners in the past quite often. Like, should Luka Modric have won it that one time? Probably not. And there's a handful more of those examples.
How dare you?
Yeah, I know. Come for me, Luka Modric. Well, as I'm sure the tax authorities often are coming for you and others. Like I just don't see the real value in the Ballon d'Or. I think there's a 0% chance Harry Kane's going to win this after Bayern Munich don't win the league. Like, yeah. Again, this is a narrative award. Harry Kane, I see where Gritty's coming from. Harry Kane has the most goals in Europe's Big Four or Big Five leagues at 32. Like, he has been dominant for Bayern Munich this season, but the pieces around him haven't been there, and that really hurts in the eyes of voters. And this award is voted on by the voters, obviously. So it's a narrative award. I think this is going to go to whoever wins the Champions League, and we're recording on Wednesday before the second leg of the second set of quarterfinals. I think it's going to go to whoever wins the Champions League of Mbappe, Haaland, and Bellingham. And the Euros could change that a little bit if Real Madrid lose to City today and Bellingham leads an incredible Euros run. In Real Madrid, obviously, are going to win the title in Spain. That could sway things. But I honestly think if Man City win the Euros, if Man City win the Champions League, Haaland's going to win the Ballon d'Or. If PSG do it, it'll be Mbappe. And if Real Madrid do it, it's going to be Bellingham. Maybe there'll be a slight tweak based on the summer, but it's a narrative thing, and everybody's paying attention to the Champions League.
Man City would win the Euros, right?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, by 100. Yeah.
Yeah. European heritage.
I love this question because it was pretty thought-provoking, but also because I did get to picture Gritty, the mascot, furiously typing at his computer while thinking about the different Ballon d'Or candidates and looking at the betting odds as well. I hope Gritty is
why is it not Daniel Gosdog? He asks. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Furiously typing, eyes darting in all directions as his head nods.
So, okay, two things. First, I think we all need to make a prediction in the honor of Ryan Bailey, who is here with us in the room today. I'm going to predict that it will be Erling Haaland who's going to do it, which is maybe a bit of an uphill battle because Norway's not in the Euros, but that's what I'm going to predict. I want both of your predictions, and I also want, do you guys care about this? Does the Ballon d'Or, maybe this is a more precise way to ask it, does the Ballon d'Or and who wins it shape your perception of players? Ryan, you can go first.
I used to watch the ceremony quite closely and be very interested
just
in
waiting
the
pageantry
for
Mr. Q to show up.
Precisely. I don't think I've watched it in years. I don't find it very important at all.
Okay.
I am going, Joe, based on your logic. I believe your logic of the Champions League winner dictating the winner.
So you're
of
going
prize.
Jude. Yep.
Exactly.
Okay.
Sticking with my guns.
It will be fascinating if it were Jude Bellingham, because I think some people maybe don't love to vote for England, and I think some people maybe don't love to vote for Real Madrid. So if he wins it, that's an interesting sign. I, Joe, to your question, do not really care about the Ballon d'Or, mostly because I think it has been a lot of the same names and faces for a very long time, which is maybe an accurate representation of the best players on the planet, but I think also I got a little bit bored of that one. So if it is somebody like Jude Bellingham coming in and winning it, I think that's fascinating because of who he is, because of what his career has been. And it does show that there is an appreciation for him, even though he is not just a machine goal scorer or something like that. So I will say, if Jude Bellingham wins, I will be genuinely excited for him and for Ryan Bailey and co. If Erling Haaland wins, I think that would be interesting because we obviously don't have Norway at the Euros, so it would not be for anything relating to European competition. And I think that might end up hurting him, or international competition, I should say, that might end up hurting him just because that will be the most recent thing, or one of the more recent things heading into that voting process will be who did what in the summer. He kind of vacationed and hung out, whereas if Mbappe does something, or Bellingham does something, or Vinicius does something, that might raise their stock a little bit heading into voting.
Okay, very good. I will say, by the way, Taylor, on the point of the Euros affecting Jude Bellingham's likelihood of winning the Ballon d'Or, I don't believe for a second he'll be allowed to do Jude Bellingham things in the England team, because the England team, since probably the 1960s, has hated fun and creativity.
Yeah, I have vague memories of, in 2022, him being the guy who sort of started to elevate that performance and be the one to make a difference in a way that certain players have for the United States in international competitions in the past, where you have one player who can sort of perform better than the rest of the team and drag them to something. I remember how much there was a commentary about, like, this teenager, this youngster is the one who seems to be leading this squad, leading this team. And if he does that again, it's a pretty compelling narrative for a pretty important soccer country, loath as I am to say that out loud.
Well, you just watch him in the screen next to Declan Rice and see how that pans out, Taylor. We will see. Thank you very much, Gritty, for the union for that question. We take a break now. When we come back, we are talking MLS expansion teams, and not just any MLS expansion team, our ones. Back shortly.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to Listener Questions. Clay Dubs, been in touch. Clay W has a question and says, you are an owner of a new MLS expansion team with an average budget for DPs. Which leagues and what types of players will you target to fill these DP spots? We want positions, we want ages, we want player profiles, we want etc., says Clay W. in his question. Joe Larry, the floor is yours.
I love this question so much. It made me so happy as I was working on it last night. I think I told Ryan and Taylor before we started that this is maybe my favorite ever question, which is, I admit, incredibly predictable, but it's awesome. And I love these kinds of thought experiments. I, funnily enough, had just sort of done a very similar experiment before the MLS season started. I wrote a piece for The Guardian about sort of the golden rules of MLS roster building. And the too long didn't read is there aren't that many golden rules because there's so many different ways you can build a roster and have success in MLS because the margins are so thin between different teams. But there are a few things that I thought about for that piece that I took out into my research for this question. So to start with, as a general principle, I have this theory that wingers are expensive and hard to find for MLS teams because they're expensive and the good ones just sort of go up very, very quickly to where they should be in the global soccer ladder. So I'm going with a narrow shape and sort of stacking the designated players through the middle. And I'm drawing real inspiration from FC Cincinnati and the Columbus Crew along the way. Mostly Cincinnati, to be honest with you. I think their turnaround a couple of years ago was just so incredibly quick. And they did it by really allocating resources through the spine and doing it in a smart way, obviously, with good scouting. So the first thing I'm looking for my first designated player is a number 10. I wrote this for The Guardian. There's no faster way to get into the playoff field in MLS than by building your team around a ball dominant playmaker. I think about a pretty mediocre Minnesota United team that's been lifted by Emmanuel Reynoso, RIP maybe, question mark, who knows, for years now. I think about the Revs with Carles Gil. They were saved by good goalkeeping, which is super important, although I'm not burning a DP spot on that because I don't have to. And Carles Gil. Like, those are the players that elevate really sort of mediocre teams into teams that are actually pulling some punches. So they're are hitting some punches, I guess. So I'm looking for a DP number 10. I am looking for a DP number 9. The profile can vary on this player. But the most important thing in terms of scouting for me is, are they getting in good spots? The finishing, the chances, that stuff will come if you're finding yourself in good positions close to goal on a regular basis. So that could be like a Cucho Hernandez type who's a little bit more flexible. It could be more of a Christian Benteke type who's physical and you can play through the air. It could be an Aaron Bupenza type. Like, there's so many ways to go with this. But my third DP is one of two things, and I'm not super sure about this one way or the other. It's either a creative number eight who can sort of go box to box, or it's a number six, sort of a destroyer. Vancouver's Andres Kubas, I think, is a great example in that category. He's a designated player. I think about Hector Herrera or Edouard Louvin for that first category, the box-to-box number eights. Guys who can contribute, especially in the attack, and then finding some sort of ball winner at the number six spot. In terms of profiles and leagues and ages and all that stuff, for age, Garth Lagerwey talks about this all the time. You want to go out and sign a designated player, sign someone who can help you. Like, sign someone who can help you win games. So that looks like players who are in their prime, 23 to 27, 28, 22, maybe on the young side. This can depend a bit if you find a superstar who is a bit younger, a bit older. But that's the age profile. In terms of leagues, it's nice to find guys who have had repeatable success, either a couple of, maybe two, three, four successful seasons in the same league, in the same club, or even better, have guys who have found success in multiple other leagues. I think about Giakoumakis with Atlanta, and again, a lot of this thinking comes from Garth Lagerwey because he talks about this stuff publicly more than anybody else. Atlanta United president Garth Lagerwey. Giakoumakis was good in the Netherlands and he was good in Scotland. Like, he produced in two leagues that are in some ways comparable to Major League Soccer, and he's come in and been excellent in MLS. So I want to look for players that have been successful in multiple stops if possible. And then for the specific leagues, Belgium is a hotspot right now for MLS teams in terms of recruitment. Josep Pansel comes from Belgium. Hugo Kuipers comes from Belgium. Both really, really big transfers in terms of impact in Pansel's case and money in Kuipers' case. Sporting Kansas City and St. Louis have had a lot of success with the kind of the bottom of the Bundesliga or the top of the second Bundesliga. LAFC, Atlanta, Vancouver, others have had success with Ligue 2, the French second tier. Turkey, I think about Aaron Bupenza coming from Turkey and Woboto as well for Cincinnati. Portugal, the Netherlands, like the right, maybe top of Celtic or Rangers kind of player, or a little bit in South America. But those are the things that I think about when I'm trying to build a team, work on the spine. I'm not convinced that going after wingers is always the best idea, although it clearly can work in LAFC's case, and look for the profiles and sort of the league success that I mentioned.
I like that, Joe. I think you've nailed it by targeting the spine. I'm lucky enough to have been privy or adjacent to an MLS team build. And at Charlotte FC, the thing they said over and over again was, when you're building a team, you start with the spine. It's obvious.
Are you trying to support or talk against my argument, Ryan?
No, I'm supporting it.
Okay. Gotcha.
So, like, is it logical then to have a DP like a center back, a central midfielder, and a forward?
No. Also, I feel like my Charlotte joke fell flat. I was trying to say that they were terrible out of the gates, and so that I wasn't exactly eager to be looped in with them. I don't think that was clear enough. I'll get in the workshop on that. Center back, no. And goalkeeper, no. For the reasons I mentioned, the same with fullback. The money in terms of salaries and salary and transfer fee are combined and amortized to determine whether a player has to be a DP or not. Like, you just don't have to pay enough as much for those players. The money makers are tilted towards the top end of the field. That's not just true in Major League Soccer. That's true everywhere. So you can go out there and find a really, really good center back, and you don't have to make him a DP. You can, and maybe there are instances where it's worthwhile for certain teams wanting to play certain ways. We talked about Walker Zimmerman in Nashville, and Zimmerman is a DP as a center back. But I really think it's worth stacking those things closer towards the top of the field. I'm even skeptical, and I know I mentioned the ball winner. Number six is maybe being the DP or the number eight. I'm even skeptical that you have to spend that DP spot on that number six. I think you might be able to find a really good one without it, but that's neither here nor there. I think generally the spine makes sense. I would just skew it like really no deeper than midfield.
And Joe, are there any sort of lessons or positives you could draw from, say, like St. Louis, for example, the way they've built?
I mean, one off-field key that I think is super important, and we talked about it this year with Montreal, with DC, we talked about it a bunch with St. Louis last year, having an identity. Like, I get frustrated sometimes when people talk about identities or philosophies or styles, like having one automatically makes you great, which clearly isn't true. It's not just this philosophical box to check, but having a clear approach to how you want to play games, an understanding of how you want to go out there and play soccer that is then clearly communicated to your players. I think about St. Louis, they have become Red Bull light in so many ways, although the Red Bulls now have changed, so it's a bit of a strange comparison. But they like to press, they like to get in your grill, they like to attack very, very quickly in transition, and every single St. Louis City player who's ever suited up for them, last season or this season, understands that. And when there is a clear idea across every player on the field and every player on the bench, that eliminates so many of these simple mistakes that you see pop up far too often for teams that are poorly coached. It means you see redundant spacing. It means you see poor movement off the ball. It means you see lack of coordination in the press. And if you lean into having an idea and communicating that, having a good idea and communicating that to your players like St. Louis did last year and like they're trying to do again this year, that I think has a lot of value, even outside of hitting on someone like Idu Luan, who I think is a fantastic player in central midfield.
So before I say anything as to this question, I will say Joe is the authority here. Ryan is probably the second authority. I am coming in third on this one. So listen to Joe. But to Ryan's question about St. Louis, that is one that I kept coming back to for two reasons. The first being that they do have a style that it feels like is not wholly dependent on any individual. They do not have a number 10 necessarily that makes them click. And if they don't have that number 10, if he's injured or on international duty, they don't know what to do. They don't have a number 9 who is elite in the way that you cannot have somebody come in and do a passable deputy job if he's not good to go. I think there is a lot of appeal to having a team that plays with an identifiable style and an identifiable philosophy so that you can then have people kind of plug and play, maybe not to the maximum degree, but to enough of a serviceable degree that it's not a huge drop off. I also kept thinking about them because of Lutz Pfannenstiel and the connections he has. And I don't have those connections. None of us do. We haven't played on every continent or every footballing continent in the world. And I think that is so critical.
Never stolen a penguin, Taylor?
Not yet. Give it time. Okay. We'll see what happens.
Okay.
But I think the connections he has and the practicality that he seems to bring, lest we forget he was obviously sporting director for a couple different clubs in Germany, including Fortuna Düsseldorf. But I think he has a level of like, this guy is good enough. I know he's good enough. I will fit him in my team and make it work. I don't have the connections to make that happen, and I don't have the scouting wherewithal to know this guy playing in the Croatian league is good enough. This guy playing in a random Scandinavian league, and I don't presume to think that I could do that. So I went in a very similar direction to Joe. I interestingly also agree that wingers is a bad idea for where you're investing money. For some reason, it's Colorado from last season that I cannot get out of my head. I remember previewing them and being like, they have 7 wingers, none of whom are good enough. I don't know what they're going to do. That's where all their money is. Unless they, I don't know, keep the ball in the wings. We'll see how it goes for Colorado. And so I think it is, for me, an Inter Milan style, like 3-5-2 with like decent enough center backs. And then I also went with a number 6, a number 10, and a number 9. My number 6 is kind of funny because I'm not even sure he's fully a number 6, but whatever. But yeah, I think you spend money on a number 10 who can be like a creator, but also sort of a support striker. So that's one of my front two, basically. So they can be a goal scorer, they can be a playmaker, but they can combine well with the other number 9. For my number 9, I went for somebody like Luke de Jong, who I think is not going to be your fleet of foot, get in behind attacker, but is going to be a good enough goal scorer in consistent moments, and it has kind of like the veteran ability to score goals. It's an odd thing to say about Luke de Jong, but it's true. He's been scoring goals for a good long while now. I was asking Joe about this, about like the best metrics or stats for tracking just like efficiency of goal scoring, because I want someone like Harry Kane or Robert Lewandowski, who I think of as being clinical. They always know where they are in relation to the goal, that if you put them within 15 yards of it, they're hitting frame at least. Maybe it's going to go in. Maybe it's going to spill for a rebound. Maybe you're going to get a corner. But I need somebody who's efficient like that. I don't think I could afford either one of them if I'm on a mid-table budget. Maybe Luke de Jong in his advanced years. Ryan is now coming in to mock me. Go ahead, Ryan.
No, to jump in, the best stat for the efficiency in front of goal is goals scored, isn't it?
No, because that can be, because it can be, you can take 100 shots and score 10 goals and you can be the top scorer in your league, but that doesn't mean that you are efficient in front of goal. That's what I'm looking for. I need somebody who, if they get 5 shots in a game, they're scoring at least one of them. And I think the numbers this is probably 2 decades ago now, but it was like, if you take 3 shots on average as a player, like the numbers back up that you would score. So I need somebody who has like that level of conversion.
I'm going to jump in very, very quickly and say that I don't really believe in anything that Taylor, you just said in terms of the finding vault. Like we have stats that can better measure players' ability to find good chances. Like I think about it, if you take 3 shots from outside the box every game, it doesn't really tell you that you're gonna score a goal every time. That's why I sort of mentioned, you know, finding good spots is super important. There are players who pretty reliably overperform their expected goals. MLS teams just can't afford those players because they're Robert Lewandowski and Harry Kane.
This is my point.
So
yeah.
I just had, Ryan came in with a comment. I had to do the same. Taylor, please continue.
Well, so that's fair. But I think that there is a thing for players who have that ability. I can't explain it other than like just know their geometry, know exactly where they are, know how to hit a shot such that they can turn, hit it first time, and know where that kind of far corner is. So at the very least, it's going to be difficult. I think that is a skill set that is overrated and properly rated simultaneously, but that's what I want, is somebody who's not just going to spurn chances and isn't just reliant on speed to get in behind, or I don't know, like next level physicality to be able to win things. I need somebody who's going to be a fox in the box, essentially. So that's what I'm going for my number 9. When my team beats Joe's, I will know that I'm correct. For my number 10, I want somebody who can create but can also link up, can also score. And then for my number 6, because it seems like there's always a designated player in every single team that isn't particularly exciting, I went for Ronny Kadira. There we go. A very specific name. Because you do have to have like that number, the DP player that I'm sort of like, oh, okay, that guy's a DP. Sure. But then it ends up being the smart move. I want a midfielder in his late 20s, early 30s, who's played consistent minutes, is going to work hard. Again, isn't fully dependent on speed, doesn't need that next level ability to be able to function within the team. I was looking for mid-tier Bundesliga talent, basically. Proven quality. You can have them sort of come in and establish a level that you expect them to play at, a level of energy and work rate. And at the same time, you then kind of build relationships with mid-tier Bundesliga clubs for future transfers. I think that's not the worst idea. But Ronny Kadira played 30 games in 5 of his last 6 seasons, 27 games in the one that wasn't over 30. Only 17 this year, so you could probably get him for a little bit cheaper of an amount. But that's a veteran Bundesliga player who I think can do what I need at the base of that midfielder as one of those midfield 3. Then I'm going for a number 10 and a number 9. Number 9 probably in like one of those sort of mid-tier European leagues. Because again, like if you go to Man City or somebody like that, you're having to spend a lot of money. And if we're maybe not trying to do that fully, given the budget restrictions Clay gave us, I think one of those European leagues is the way to go. My dog is barking in the background. She agrees.
She does indeed. I'm looking through Clay's question. If you want my answer, the first part of his question is, you're the owner of a new MLS expansion team. I'm the owner, so I'm hiring a really good sporting director and I'm diving in my Scrooge McDuck bank vault for the rest of the day.
Yep.
That's how I'm answering the question.
That's the best answer of any of the 3 answers, Ryan. Well done.
Thank you very much. And speaking of sporting directors, Robert Hatch has a question. Is being a GM the best job in the world? If they mess up and sign terrible players, they get to fire the coach and blame them. If they're successful, they get all the credit for signing amazing players. Now, Joe, we've established on TSS that the best job in soccer is third choice goalkeeper for a Premier League team. Best gig in sports.
Specifically Manchester City. Shout out Scott Carson.
Specifically Scott Carson's job. But the GM, Robert's got a point here. They get to hide behind the coach and players when there's a storm, right?
Yeah. This is, I think, the best job in soccer in a lot of ways. I don't agree with the second part of this question, though. If they're successful, they get all the credit for signing amazing players. That doesn't happen at all. And it should, right? Or at least they should get some credit for that. But I think about Bayer Leverkusen. The amount of times we talked about them this season, I've mentioned Simon Rolfe once. Graham has mentioned him once. And maybe Ryan or Taylor, you guys snuck in a reference along the way. I don't remember that. He is the managing director of sport for Bayer Leverkusen. I talked about him actually at some length in the Big Thing episode that we did. Again, sorry you weren't on that one, Taylor. I know that still hurts you to this day.
The question was about GMs, not managing directors of sport. How dare
same
you?
Job, right? All these jobs, CSO and MLS, sporting director, general manager, all basically do the same thing. And he deserves a ton of credit because how rosters are assembled and the quality of players in a team is the single largest factor behind a team's success. So, they don't get as much credit as they should, but they also do get to use coaches as a human meat shield, which is awesome and a really, really big perk in any job that you're maybe not so good at. So if anybody wants to know if this is the best job in soccer off the field, which I think it is, just ask Georg Kites, who is somehow still employed by the Chicago Fire.
Woof. Taylor, your thoughts on this one? GM, best job in sports? You got a layer of protection there. I think maybe for if you know crowd, then you get the credit, right?
Yeah, I think so. And if you've sort of done it well enough, consistently enough, like there's a reason we know Garth Lagerwey. I think like Theo Epstein for baseball is another one of those where if you are credited, Billy Beane, if you're credited with bringing about a change in the organization or a fundamental implanting of their new DNA, then maybe you do get that credit. Short of that, I think Joe is correct. It tends to be the manager and the players who get all the credit, and the sporting director keeps their job. But at the same time, if it's a bad season, if some of those signings don't pay off, maybe there's a little bit of pressure, and I feel like you'll get that from some of your supporters. But for the most part, I think it's always going to be the coach who gets the pressure first, then maybe some of the players. So at the very least, if you get hired into this position, you're probably getting at least 3 years, I would say, of gainful employment before maybe things take a turn. I'm not sure if that's been the case in Chicago, Joe. That's the one where I would think of it being the most volatile GM situation. But I also feel like they haven't been quick to really change things over. So it does feel like one where you have a built-in layer of support, but also protection. I think it's a pretty good gig overall.
It should be more volatile in Chicago than it is. Like, Gerrit Kaitz has been around for 5 years, I think it is now, and his team's been bad pretty consistently. So, yeah, it's weird. I think this is a great question because it really does get at some of the weird ways that we talk about teams and the weird ways that teams run themselves. When you look at a team that just doesn't have a lot of quality in it, that is consistently missed on transfers, how often, I'll just stick on the media side because that's what we're in, how often do we go out there and blame the club or blame the person responsible for bringing those players in instead of blaming a manager or blaming some of their tactical approach? Not that those things might not be problematic. Like, it's very possible when we talk about Manchester United that Erik ten Hag is not helping things, right? That is entirely possible. But when I look at Manchester United, I think about how it's crazy that in their front four, they don't have a single player that would start for any of the teams in the title conversation in the Premier League this year. Like, that's what I think about when you look at a team that really is struggling and is not performing up to expectations. So I love this question because I think it really gets at, like, some of the flawed conversations that we have about how soccer teams work and what's wrong with them specifically. So yes, I'll take the GM job over the manager's job. Thank you.
Yeah, Joe, if I was to push back on it being the best job, it doesn't still have great job security, does it? You're still at the whims of an owner if things do go wrong, if they are going to clear house, if they are going to change things up.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be getting like a 30-year mortgage in any city because of, you know, things could move any time, right?
Well, you also might not need a mortgage given what you might be paid. So, like, there's a little bit of ups and downs here, right? I don't think it is the most stable job in the world. It's more stable, certainly, than being a manager. And what it lacks in some stability relative to maybe an office job or, you know, remote job or whatever it is, it probably makes up for in fun, but then also loses in stress. So, I don't know. Use caution when applying for one of these jobs, I suppose.
I have the important question that we all need to know the answer to. If you both got the gig as a GM, are you going to be the energetic GM who, when the goal is scored, you're on camera cheering? Or are you one of the Bayern directors who are always just sort of, no matter what the result, very quizzical and like concerned about what's happening and never very pleased? Which way are you going?
I'm going energy all the way, Taylor. We live in the world where Man City fans make banners for their executives. I want some banners, baby.
Ryan wants banners. Joe?
I'm just going to become a lawyer for Man City and get my own banner that way. I think that's how I'm going. No, I'm just going to punch numbers into my calculator after each goal that we score.
That sounds right.
Adjust the algorithm, everybody. Good stuff. All right. Thank you very much, Robert, for your question. We take a quick break now. When we come back, we're talking tactics and we're talking about a brand new league coming to America. Back shortly.
Today's episode is brought to you by our old friends, Mack Weldon. Wouldn't it be nice if we could have things both ways, like a zero-calorie cheeseburger, internet ads in March that weren't just reminders to do your taxes, a dog that never needs walking after midnight when it's cold, a Manchester United that is consistently good instead of their current scattershot approach? Well, we tend to think of clothing as an either-or situation as well. People think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort. But it's possible to have it both ways. Mack Weldon makes timeless apparel with modern performance fabrics for guys who want to look and feel sharp without sacrificing comfort. From their light-as-air underwear to innovative anti-odor tees and versatile yet comfortable pants, Mack Weldon has a full range of clothes that never go out of style. I got a few things recently, including a long-sleeve polo, which I love, maybe the most comfortable t-shirt, which I also love, and my new favorite sweatpants, the Ace sweatpant. It's exactly what I described above, comfort and versatile, but still stylish. It's the type of sweatpant I can wear to pick up my kids from daycare and not think, I'm now wearing sweatpants in public. The other parents will judge me. Now I just think, judge away, nerds, because you will never be this comfortable unless you're also wearing a pair, in which case, high five. Mack Weldon is not flashy. It's just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. They're designed to fit both your style and the demands of modern life. So get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code TSS. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code TSS to get 20% off your first order. Thank you to Mack Weldon for sponsoring today's episode.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, we are answering listener questions, including but not limited to this one from Kenny Sides. Kenneth Sidon has been in touch. It's a frequent theme that tactics are cyclical, but is there anything done in the past 5 years that is unique? Past 5 years or so, I should say, Ken says specifically. Joe, is it fair to say, I mean, obviously tactics are cyclical, but they are evolved at the same time. There's evolution within the cycles, right? So like the press now isn't the same as the press it was in the previous cycle, etc. and so on.
Yeah, that's kind of exactly how I would think about it, Ryan. Tactics have very much changed from when soccer really gains a hold at the end of the 1800s and progresses through the 1900s and now into the 2000s. Things have changed. There are things, though, that feel like they're blasts from the past in terms of, like, every once in a while, man marking seems to come back in vogue. And every once in a while, you start to see, like, possession shapes that really mirror what somehow they stumbled upon in the late 19th century. So there are some ties. It's not like just this one big cycle where everything we see now happened exactly 100 years ago. But there are some themes that certainly do seem to pop up again. But evolution is really where my mind went first on this, Ryan. Specifically when it comes to set pieces. Set pieces have existed for a long time. But if I'm thinking about something that's really changed and evolved tactically over the last 5 years, there is some open play stuff, which I'll get to shortly. But it is what happens on dead balls. I think about goal kicks now being able to be taken inside the box and how that changes buildup and how that changes some of the angles of defensive pressure, all that stuff. That changed, I think, in 2019. That rule was adjusted. So that changed things and how teams possess the ball in the back and some of the incentives or lack thereof to do and take different risks in possession and in your press. I think about set piece coaches and throw-in coaches, like you getting clear buy-in on that front from even some of the biggest teams in the world. Arsenal scored a bajillion goals on set pieces so far this season. That's been a huge part of their attempt to win the title that feels like it's going to fall short, but who knows? Liverpool, you know, contracting a throw-in coach and you having some of that in Denmark and in the US and all around the world now. Think about Pep even working with the ball boys, like all of those little marginal things that we don't spend a lot of time talking about, but that do play a real part in tactics on the field. And then I think about, Ryan, I think you mentioned pressing in your lead into this one. I think about pressing schemes, and I think there's been more and more defensive analysis happening over the last several years, maybe the last decade, a little bit less than that. Teams being very detailed in how and when they press, whether they're going man through midfield, whether they're going zonal, whether they're doing a hybrid in their press as they go and try to constrict the opposing team's build-up play. It feels like more of that stuff. There's more of that stuff, and it's more detailed now than there's ever been. So those are a few of the things that came to mind for me. I'm sure there's a bunch of other stuff as well. I think about all the center backs we're seeing on the field now with like Man City and Arsenal. There's part of me that thinks like that's what Kenneth means when tactics are cyclical, because you think about the pyramid shape, this sort of 2-3-5 that was popular sort of when the game first started. And you're looking at a lot of players in a pretty similar alignment to what we see a lot of the time now. But I think the center backs, at least in the modern age, that's maybe something new as well.
I hear that pyramid was inverted, by the way.
I've heard that as well. I don't know. I can't confirm, but it does seem that way.
But even like Roberto Martinez's Belgium team had four center backs, but that was because they didn't have any good fullbacks. They had a lot of center backs, and even there, they're used differently than I think like the modern, or at least this season's incarnation of four center backs are utilized. Joe, so that was on my list, is the usage of four center backs, but using them in markedly different ways. I think within that, or related to that, would be, I'm not exactly sure when it first started happening, but it's been a while, but the fullback moving into the center midfield, I mean, that's at least going back to like when Berhalter is first hired, because that's the thing he's trying to bring in. That to me is a Pep, like innovation, but maybe that's existed before Pep. But that is definitely one that I think of as being a little bit game changing, and now is kind of ubiquitous. But the idea of a fullback becoming a central midfielder, I think, creates numbers in areas that we didn't expect to have numbers if you have other central midfielders moving into more advanced positions or moving out wide. So that I think is pretty it's an interesting development that has had pretty big ripples throughout soccer. And then a more like individual one that I always think about with this type of question is Hamburg of the last couple of years playing in this in the is it Zweite Bundesliga? Not Zwei Bundesliga, but Zweite.
Zweite, yeah.
Anyway, thank you, Ryan. But using their goalkeeper in possession, but not just in the kind of build out, but 30 and 40 yards from their own goal, coming under pressure, but playing as basically a center back in distribution, and in that way, basically giving you another outfield player much closer to goal. It allows you to push more players further up. So it has had some success. Obviously, it has not had complete success because they have stayed in the second division for a good long while, Hamburg. But I think the kind of that next step in how to use your goalkeeper in possession to create opportunities, it's not one that I feel like we've seen happen a ton. We've seen goalkeepers come off their line to make plays. We've seen goalkeepers obviously in possession and in distribution almost like to a slavish degree. If like if you're Petr Cech and you cannot pass the ball, but you're being asked to do so, you're going to try anyway. But I think about a goalkeeper then being involved in possession 40 yards from their own goal as being somewhat innovative.
Yeah. Joe, you made me think when you mentioned the new rules and how that dictates changes in tactics. Like even like the kickoff having to going backwards, or the, as you mentioned, the goal kicks being within the box. Is that a way of saying maybe those are the most unique changes in tactics we've seen because they've come from scenarios that never happened before?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely an element of that, Ryan, where there was not the possibility of this thing existing before, and now it has changed the game. We think about the offside rule changing, and that has a real impact on how teams play. So yeah, all that stuff I think does play a very real part in the, I mean, they're subtle, but the very real evolutions that we see in this sport.
Okay, final question for you, Joe. How long until 442 Lump It to the Big Man truly comes back to the world stage?
Never. Never is my answer. I think, so there's a real part of me that thinks, even though I see where you're coming from, Ryan, like all the tactics that we talk about are from the big teams, right? Like we talk about Pep, we talk about Klopp, we talk about all these guys, right? Because they're the teams that we and everybody else spend the most time watching as a collective. And those teams have the most expensive players, and the most expensive players want to play pretty soccer. And I don't know that that's going to change unless, Ryan, this is what you should do with your MLS expansion team. You should get the 4-4-2 long ball trendy again. And that is when players are going to want to adopt that stuff. And that's when we see it come back on the world stage.
Make MLS great again. Let's start the campaign, Joe. I love it. Love it. I'm on it. Thank you very much. Ken, thank you very much for your question. One more for this episode from Kurt Walker. You're probably already all over this, says Kurt, but what is NSL America? Kurt, I can inform you, I don't think we were all over this. NSL America, NSLofficial.com listener, if you want to check it out. It is a new professional American soccer league, which is purported to arrive in 2025. Taylor, the key here is that it's new, but we're seeing some old flavors here, some old team names, old NASL team names being resurrected, the Washington Diplomats, Chicago Sting, LA Aztecs, and so on. Are you excited for more soccer coming next year, Taylor?
No, because it's not. Ryan, doing a good job of setting the stage for a league that I do not think will exist. This was briefly on my radar and then completely fell off such that I had to start Googling it, and slowly I remembered, oh yes, this thing, which...
When did it make your radar, by the way?
I think we were asked about this at one point, on or we were discussing it maybe like
just now?
Pre-show. No, like I think the four of us discussed it a long time ago because Graham was, I think, the one to be like, this doesn't seem like it's going to be a real thing.
Okay.
Maybe around the time of the 2022 World Cup, that's too early in this process. But I remember it being a conversation, and I remember slowly realizing it was probably not going to happen. There's a very good summary of an exchange that Mark Fishkin had on Twitter with a since-deleted account for this league. But it's basically Scott Matchmaker Michaels is a British entrepreneur who previously has zero experience in soccer at all. He owns several companies that all purport to be soccer-related or football-related. Questionable what he actually has done in soccer. I think he claims to be an agent. But he basically re-registered trademarks of defunct American teams like the ones Ryan mentioned, and then used a lot of buzzwords like pro-rel, community-centric, player development, affordable, all of these things to generate interest in a hypothetical league that I also think would not be connected to U.S. soccer. So I don't know how that would have gone over. But And then I think there were conversations about fundraising. I don't know if that ever actually happened, but it was meant to be a grassroots league that would sort of harken back to the, I believe in his video, he called it the golden age of soccer in this country. I'm not sure the 1970s were the golden age of soccer in this country, but whatever. So I don't know if it was ever actually going to be a thing, although the jerseys are nice, and maybe that was part of the plan all along.
Go watch your local USL team or NWSL team instead of thinking or looking into this. Like, I cannot emphasize that strongly enough. I don't think this is ever going to exist. I was messaging with someone and very much get this impression from doing my research as well. It feels both like fake and scammy, and like it would be better off as maybe an apparel company than a soccer league. I obviously don't know this guy. I don't know what his real ambition is. I will be absolutely shocked if this is ever a real soccer league. Go watch your local soccer team instead.
Okay. Well, I'm sensing a heavy dose of skepticism from the TSS crew here. A question I have, something we talked about earlier, guys. They've got the license to some sort of legendary, iconic team names, the Diplomats, the Sting, the Aztecs, and so on. Rather than going through the expense of launching a league and the difficulty and the risk of launching a league, why don't they just make a bunch of great merch using that licensing? And that would be a good way to make money.
So I don't know much about Scott, the person in question, who I believe was the sole individual involved in this league. So I don't want to say this is the case for him, but I will say, generally speaking, if you're making merch, you can sell that merch, and you're creating a product, and then you're selling it on, and you might make some money. You might not make a ton of money, but I believe the starter fundraising effort was $50,000. If you wanted to chip in $50,000 as a way to help finance this league, that was an opportunity on like FundraiserNet or whatever it was. It was a weird website where you could go. And again, not saying this is Scott Michaels necessarily, but maybe a person trying to do something like this who was trying to raise money in a large amount for a thing that would get a lot of people excited might have ulterior motives. The words that Joe used come to mind.
Okay. Fire truck of lawyers, stand by before we take this conversation any further. But hey, who knows? Maybe you guys will be eating humble pie when we're all celebrating NSL teams and watching them on Paramount Plus streams next year. You never know. Anyway,
is NSL not trademarked already? That feels like a thing that has to be trademarked already.
NASL, I imagine, is. Maybe not NSL. But, Joe, is it good or bad to have more
it's
soccer leagues and different
NSL
soccer
is a trademark of National Sealants and Lubricants.
Great.
There we go.
I mean, MLS is something else as well, if you look that up, Taylor, too, to be fair, in the housing
true,
market.
True.
Joe, do we like having more leagues and more teams, regardless of what you think about this particular entity? If there was another entity that was launching and it had teams in areas that don't have teams currently, etc. and so on, would you like that, or would you say let's strengthen the current league systems that we have?
I would say the second of those things. More teams and more soccer, I think, is good. I am not sure, and this ties into the conversation we had about the USL Super League, I'm not sure that fracturing at this point is particularly helpful. There's been a lot of that over the years. There will likely still be some of that that we're yet to see. More teams, more soccer, more opportunities for people to go, watch, play, experience, be involved in the sport. All of that stuff is good. Do it in a smart way. And this just really does not feel like there's any single part of it that is smart or going to be successful.
Taylor, what if this was, what's the league that Pablo wrote about in The Athletic where it was like kind of wrestling and kind of soccer at the same time?
What if it was, I don't remember, but that was awesome.
I like hybrid sports. What if it was dog racing combined with soccer?
Dude.
How do we make that happen?
Dude.
Dog racing's not a thing. That's canon. We've established that.
Don't
Greyhound racing
me.
Doesn't happen. Anyway, let's wrap it there, shall we? Kurt Walker, thank you very much for that question and all questions we have received on this here episode. We've got a bonus question about Weston McKennie coming on the Patreon feed, patreon.com/Total Soccer Show, if you would like to support the Total Soccer Show. Please, and a thank you. But for now, Taylor Rockwell, answering of questions was done superbly on your part. Thank you very much.
It was done okayly on my part. I think Joe was doing a lot of heavy lifting on this episode. Well done to Joe.
Joe, new squat lifting record on those question answerings, bro.
No, you guys all
maxed
did great.
It.
This was fun. It was a pleasure to be a corner of the power trio with you all.
Indeed. Power Trio rages on. Thank you very much, listener, for joining us. Power Trio will be back on the feed very shortly, but for now, bye!